In this episode of Pemba On Demand, Leadership Odyssey, Bridging Medicine and Business, my guest is Dr. Michael Marks. Michael is the Senior Medical Director for Relievant Med Systems. Dr. Marks began his odyssey as an orthopedic spine surgeon in Connecticut. He has had an amazing career and many leadership lessons to share.
Welcome to Pemba On Demand. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. I am very excited to welcome you to our podcast. Pemba On Demand is produced for physicians interested in professional development. We will be discussing a wide range of topics on the podcast. I will be interviewing physician leaders from the U.S. and from other countries who have graduated from the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee. These physicians will be sharing stories of professional and personal growth, overcoming challenges in their organizations, and discussing key leadership skills they have learned from the MBA program and ongoing professional development.
Michael, welcome to Pemba On Demand. I'm excited to have you on the show today and discuss your journey, your odyssey, from spine surgeon to senior medical director at Relievant Med Systems, now owned by Boston Scientific. I thought maybe we could just start by having you sharing your odyssey, your transition from a practicing orthopedic spine surgeon in Connecticut, your current role as senior medical director for Relievant.
Norm, happy to be here. Happy to talk to Pemba active people and alumni. How much time do you have? It's been a long journey. I did Pemba in 2021, and it's now starting on 24 years later when the class of 2025 comes in. So I'm happy to give you as much or as little information as you like.
Well, why don't you start with kind of a high-level overview about your career, your professional journey, and then maybe I'll break it down and tease out some specific element from each of those roles.
Okay. So I started off as an orthopedic spine surgeon doing all of orthopedics when I began in 1988. And shortly thereafter, while being in practice, we had Bill Clinton as president, and he wanted to reform our healthcare system. And so I knew at that point, based upon all the discussions going on, that I wasn't sure that I actually had the skill set to navigate what was going to be ahead of me. So I started looking at various different programs and actually came upon the Pemba program, which was truly in its infancy at that point. In 1999-2000, submitted an application in the summer of 2000 and enrolled in January of 2001. And for me, I said it at that time, and it's now hard to believe almost a quarter century later, probably was the most important academic endeavor that I ever participated in. And it was just so unique at that time, and I think still it applies today. The fact is that it is still the only physician-only, fully accredited, one-year MBA program in the country. Really surprised, at least that I'm aware of, that nobody has tried to copy that. And also, for all of us who have been on this medical journey, it's the only academic endeavor that was a calendar year, which truly was a unique experience. You start something in January and you end it in December.
And at the time that you matriculated into the MBA, did you have a leadership role? Was your role as just a clinician at that time?
So my role was as a clinician. I'd been involved in various different committees at my hospital, Norwalk Hospital in Norwalk, Connecticut. But the senior partner who had founded the group in 1963 had come up to me and said, look, you know, the guys between me and you, they don't seem that interested in the administrative aspect of running this practice. Mm-hmm. You've asked a lot of questions along the way, and we really see this MBA program as preparing you for leadership of this group. Now, while all this was going on, there were lots of mergers and acquisitions going on in healthcare. And Norwalk, Connecticut basically had two large orthopedic groups. And my OAP was actually a business plan on how you merge two orthopedic groups together. And it really became the blueprint for what we went ahead to do. And with that, I then went on to become the president of this merged group.
And how quickly after you completed the MBA did you assume that role?
So I completed the MBA at the end of 2001. It took us about a year to work through all of that. So probably in about 2003, we had merged the groups together, getting through all the regulatory aspects But again, merging different entities together is a real challenge. Culture, because people in the community had a hard time believing that the two of us, two large groups, could get together, because we were always looked at as the Hatfields and the McCoys. We were always sort of feuding and pushing back and forth. It was either us or them, and pushed forward and had a very successful group. Although, obviously, with mergers / acquisitions, there were always bumps in the road.
So what were some of the, what was your most effective tool or strategy that you used to try to merge those two groups together? Were there cultural differences? Were there strategic differences? I assume that you operated the same hospital organizations, had privileges at the same facilities.
Yeah, the biggest challenge was that it's getting your office staff to realize that Dr. Marx is no longer the enemy, that he's a good guy, he's all part of us. So what we actually did is we swapped doctors until we got our real estate sort of organized. We still had different facilities. And so I would actually go to their facility staff to be a doctor, do my office hours partially there. And that actually did a great job for culture and for people realizing that we're all here with the same purpose. And it really did help tremendously. And I think that to some extent, not to get too political today, but that's really the major challenge that I heard from Senator Simpson and Erskine Bowles years ago, when Obama put them together. And they go, we were always taught to hate each other. One was a Democrat, one was a Republican. But when they started working together, they found that they had more in common than they did in difference. And that's really what we had found when we started mixing the cultures. Unless you do that. And through the whole thing, we only had probably 60 employees that we eventually became. Only one or two found that they couldn't acclimate to the new culture. So I think that was really a step in the right direction, mixing the culture early on so that you didn't maintain what could have been some terrible tribalism.
Sounds like a very successful merger. I've been part of several hospital mergers and acquisitions, and merging two medical staffs together is somewhat of a larger scale opportunity, but the cultural differences between hospital organizations can sometimes be very challenging to bring together. And many physicians, I think, have gravitated towards one hospital or another based on the culture at the hospital and based on their preferences. And so those have been somewhat challenging, but it sounds like your approach was very successful.
It was certainly successful. We went on to continue to grow the group. We became a 14-person multi-specialty musculoskeletal group. Really happy. And there are always bumps in the road, but the key is with any discussion, is to demonstrate empathy, not get angry, and continue to move forward and always keep your eye on what is the goal. What do we ultimately want to do? And that was to have a very large, successful orthopedic group within the area. And that continued to give great satisfaction to me. I continued to look for other leadership roles. I became president of the Connecticut Orthopedic Society for a two-year term in the mid-2000s while we were dealing with the group. I then became assistant chief of staff and chief of staff at Norwalk Hospital. So all of those opportunities allowed me to use the various different skill sets that I obtained while going through the PEMBA program. And I think one of the big questions a lot of people get when they wind up doing an executive program is, so what are you going to do with it? And I think it's okay to go into it and saying, well, I'm not really sure, because education, and we've talked about this before, education is really important. When I began my practice, that senior doctor who had begun the practice a quarter century before, in the early 1960s, when I joined the group, he was doing knee arthroscopy and total hip replacements. And I said, Jerry, none of these existed when you began your practice in the mid-60s. He goes, yeah, even Medicare didn't exist when I began practice. And I said, why are you doing these? He said, well, because all I did was fix a lot of fractures, make a lot of big scars on people's bodies. But I realized if I was going to continue to be relevant as a clinician, you must continue with continuing education. And I really do look at, for me personally, and for those people that have an administrative ill, that PEMBA gives you that. That's that continuing education. It's not medical education in this case, although we're using it hopefully in a medical field, but it's really broadening our skill set to be able to take on additional challenges.
So what was your next, after you merged the group together, what was your next leadership opportunity that you found besides the involvement with the medical society?
So as it turns out, just like the shoemaker's children don't have good shoes, the spine surgeon did not have a very good back. And between 1981 and 1996, I'd had three surgical discectomies performed. And those of us who are in the field know that when you operate upon a disc and remove the herniation, you do not have a normal disc. And I went on to develop degenerative disc disease. So while I was chief of staff at Norwalk Hospital, and as orthopedics had moved minimally invasive, I was wearing lead 8 hours a day, 2 to 3 days a week. And I started developing some really severe low back pain. I had some additional studies done. Pain management doctor in my group began performing procedures on me to get some relief. But by 2010, I really had little to no quality of life. I took my MRIs, sent them to 7 different colleagues, and got back 5 different opinions, which unfortunately is a frequent occurrence within the world of spine surgery. So my wife, who'd been with me since the first year of medical school and had been on this journey and odyssey with me, said, okay, if there's no surgical solution, what would you tell your patients? You need to modify your lifestyle and whatever you do to minimize your pain. And so Norwalk Hospital had a new president at that time. I'd worked closely with him. And he said, hey, we really don't have any physician leadership in the hospital here. Would you come join the administration so that we can have some physician input on when we're making decisions? So I wound up doing that beginning in 2010 and into 2011 and left my orthopedic group. It created initially some harsh feelings. Some of them thought that I had abandoned them as healthcare was becoming tougher. And because I really kept my medical problems to myself, and it was only afterwards that they realized that I was really struggling physically, that they softened a little bit. And I probably should have been a little bit more open in retrospect of the challenges that I was having. But I love seeing and caring for patients. So our hospital had a monthly orthopedic clinic. And part of my negotiating, which people would think is kind of crazy, but part of my negotiating of taking the job was I wanted to turn that into a weekly orthopedic clinic for the indigent. And so my former partners were happy. They no longer had to cover the orthopedic clinic. The only proviso was if somebody needed surgery, they would be willing to go ahead and perform that surgery. So I continued to see patients clinically, even though I had this administrative role now as vice president for business development.
How many hours a week were you providing patient care?
So it was one day a week for about three and a half hours.
And did you ever experience pushback or biases, concerns regarding your limiting your clinical time to that amount and whether it impacted your effectiveness as a physician leader?
So I think that by continuing to see patients and struggling with the electronic medical record, which again, you know, we're dealing with people that have no insurance and navigating the maze of trying to get these patients, many of which were not English speaking. Norwalk has multiple different cultures with it. And so most of the time I was using an interpreter either for Greek or Spanish or Portuguese or some Slavic language in order to care for these patients. But I think I didn't get any pushback because I think people realized that I was still there. Initially, the statement or the discussion is, oh, he's gone to the dark side. And what I really tried to do was have a foot in each camp, which can be a challenge. It's like we talk about, you know, having a foot in two canoes. You know, where's your balance? And basically, do you end up falling? And, you know, you're not in either canoe, but you're in the water all by yourself. And so it is a challenge. But I think these challenges are all met. And I go back to that example I used when we merged the two groups, is it has to be discussions. If you don't have discussions and keep things open, people develop their own preconceived notions, just like my former partners. They thought that I was abandoning them, as opposed to I just needed to transition to a different career because of physical limitations.
It's an interesting dilemma that I find when I talk to many physician leaders is that in the medical field, specifically, I think with physicians, there's this idea that you need to be able to do the job and experience the job clinically in order to be an effective leader. And in many other areas of business, the role of a coach, for example, in professional football, has nothing to do with whether they can throw a 60-yard pass or run a defensive play of some type. But in medicine, we seem to hang on to this idea that if you don't do what I do, you can't tell me how to do it better. What is your take on that, especially as you have begun to supervise physicians who were not necessarily orthopedists?
It's a great question, and it is a challenge. And, you know, here we are more than a decade after I ventured into that world. And my job as Vice President of Business Development was to lead the expansion of the employed physician group. And we grew it from somewhere between 35 to probably just under 200 physicians over a 4-year period of time. But I had a lot of the trust for these physicians because I'd been chief of staff and I'd been advocating on their behalf beforehand. And one of the things that was interesting was when I took the job, I asked the president of the hospital to take a look at the current employed physician contract. And I looked at it and I said to him, this contract has to go. I said, I'm surprised you've got 35 doctors as employed, because it was really so punitive. And so, again, one of the discussions from Pemba and operations with Chuck Noon was all about how every negotiation ultimately should be able to become a win-win. And that's something, unfortunately, we as a society, I don't think have the mentality to understand that you can grow the pie and every negotiation should be a win-win, because the problem becomes if it's a win-lose, you get to win that negotiation once.
Yeah.
After that, that person feels they've been taken advantage of and they're going to stick their heels in. And so redrafted an employee contract that really was fair to both sides, including compensation and bonuses based upon citizenship. Many of these employed physician contracts are all RVU-based. Well, I didn't want people to just be churning RVUs. I wanted them to be providing good care, that their press gain scores were good, that they participated in committees, because prior to this, if you sat on some committee at the hospital, that was time you basically gave away. We created surrogate RVUs or specific stipends. If you attended a committee meeting, you were paid for that. And that went for both the employed physician and the independent physicians within the community, because time is valuable. Time is something we don't have the ability to grow more of. And if somebody's giving of their time, there should be some compensation. Otherwise, you were just having a whole group of people that, you know, were voting with their feet because they felt that they couldn't or wouldn't want to participate.
This podcast is sponsored by the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville's Haslam College of Business. In less than one calendar year, this program will equip you with valuable business acumen and leadership development not found in traditional medical school curriculum. Are you ready to join the longest-running physician-only MBA program in the country and a network of nearly 1,000 Pemba graduates? Visit tiny.utk.edu/podcast for information about this exciting opportunity. And now we'll return to the episode.
Did you find that that approach was an effective retention tool for you? Were you able to compare the retention in your group compared to other system medical groups?
didn't really have an ability to compare it, but I do think that it very much had a positive impact because we had more involvement on the committee level where people were, you know, were volunteering now to sit on credentials committee, to sit on other patient safety committees, because again, it created a win-win. Ultimately, these participation in the various committees had a positive impact upon them, but at the same time, they were also getting some compensation for it.
So I know that you eventually you transitioned away from your leadership role of vice president of development and your involvement with the system medical group. What led to that change, and what was the next step in your journey after that?
So as I said, Pemba was really one of the most impactful educational experiences I had. And each time I hear a story, I think of one of the professors, you know, sort of whispering in our ears or standing in the front of the lecture hall talking to us. And I clearly remember when Mike Stahl gave us the lecture on mergers and acquisitions. He said there are no such things as mergers. They're all acquisitions. And it depends how significant that acquisition was. So in 2014 or thereabout, Norwalk Hospital, and I'll use the word, was acquired by Western Connecticut Health Network. This is not anything that anybody in the New England area is unfamiliar with at this point. But, you know, they had their definite plans of what they wanted this three-hospital system to be. And the legacy people at Norwalk, for the most part, were not really part of that plan. And so 8 to 10 months into that, we'll say, acquisition, it became evident to me that this was not where I was going to, you know, finish out my plan. Even though I had been at Norwalk Hospital at this point for, I guess, 27, 28 years. And so I seriously began looking for other hospital administration jobs around the country, because in Connecticut, there really weren't any openings or any other things that I felt that I would be equipped for. And then I looked at jobs in California, in Florida, North Carolina, the Midwest, in Colorado. And then one night I woke up probably in a cold sweat and said to myself, wait a second, you're going to go ahead and get another, you're going to pick yourself up. At this point, my wife and I are empty nesters. We're going to move someplace. But what happens if you find yourself in the same situation again, where your hospital then gets acquired and your services are no longer required? So that's when I began reaching out to various different colleagues, mentors, and said, well, what do you think I should do? And they go, well, you've got a broad skill set. And that actually became part of the challenge with my job search, because when I would speak to recruiters, they go, well, what kind of job do you want? And I go, one that's fun. Because if work isn't fun, then it's really work. When it's fun, it's really not work. And I went ahead and they said, well, you've got the skill set to be a COO, a CMO, a vice president for business development. And that actually probably hindered the job search a little bit as with the various different recruiters, because I wasn't specific enough of what area I wanted to be in. And so they said, start your own healthcare consulting company. I'd already done some consulting work a little bit on the side for one of the largest orthopedic coding companies in the country. I'd done some work for MedMal companies. I'd done some medical legal work. And so in essence, my consulting business was that I was a subcontractor to a lot of larger other companies. And the one thing I did do was take 3 months off after leaving the hospital just to sort of unwind, decompress, get my mindset on what I was going to do in my next transition, my next journey, my next odyssey that I was going on. And extremely successful, but for my commitment to patients and patient care, I still continued through 2017 to do that indigent clinic on a weekly basis. And so even though I was sort of persona non grata, my dedication was to make sure that these people were going to get the right care. So I continued to do that, and I added another. In many of Pemba people may have heard of AmeriCares. AmeriCares provides services to those in need all over the country. Well, their corporate headquarters is in Southwest Connecticut, and they had a indigent clinic in South Norwalk. And so I added another clinic day, and when I do that once or twice a month. So again, deep down inside, I had all of these administrative roles. I was doing all these non-medical things. But my feeling was I'd spent so much time in the medical field that I really wanted to continue to use my skill sets. Still was a member of the North American Spine Society, still a member of the Orthopedic Academy, even though I wasn't a full clinician. Because again, thinking back to my senior partner's statement, you have to continue with your education, otherwise you fall behind. And so that led to, in 2017, one of the clients who came to me was some people I'd done some consulting work in the early 2000s who were the principals of Kyphon. Kyphon had developed a surgical procedure to address vertebral compression fractures. And they said that they were now part of a new company called Relievant Med Systems. And they had just gotten their FDA clearance for their device. And that they needed help on coding and reimbursement. Would I do some consulting work for them? So I said, sure. I said, but what do you do? Because if I'm going to help you, I need to understand it. And the response was, well, we've developed a technique to eliminate chronic low back pain by ablating the basal vertebral nerve, which is located inside the vertebral body. And I said, wait a second. Inside the vertebral body? And they go, yes. I said, when was this nerve discovered? Because I don't remember hearing about it in medical school or in any of books. And the response was, well, it was published by Antonacci and Hegenis in the Journal of Spinal Disorders in 1998. I said, well, that's a problem, because that was 16 years after I finished medical school, and I didn't subscribe to that journal. So, long story short, they found out that this nerve was responsible for probably the vast majority of what people have as degenerative disc disease. It had basically been called discogenic pain, but there's really very little nerve innervation in the disc. The nerve innervation turns out to be mostly at the end plates. And so when you degenerate a disc, it leads to a visual finding on MRIs called modic changes, M-O-D-I-C. And then when they're explaining all this, I start laughing because I did my spine fellowship at the Cleveland Clinic in 1987. And we had started multidisciplinary rounds. And with these multidisciplinary rounds, it was neuroradiology's turn in the October, November of 87. And the neuroradiologist, while the rest of the country is struggling to get an MRI machine once a week at their hospital, and for the younger physicians, they're going to find that that's rather incredible. But MRIs used to travel around the state of Connecticut in a mobile van, and each hospital got one day a week. Well, the Cleveland Clinic at that point already had two permanent magnets, and they basically probably MRI'd all 700,000 people in the city of Cleveland to find out what do these images look like. And the neuroradiologist throws up all these images and asks us what we see. And we said, Mike, there are 150 images. What do you want us to see? He says, well, we've got these bright spots and dark spots. I'm calling them modic changes. And we said, Mike, great. You've named something after yourself. His name was Mike Modic, is Mike Modic. And we said, great. What's the clinical significance? And his response was, I have no idea, but somebody's going to find out someday. So for me, I really feel like I came full circle now with this consulting job. And so I went home and I wound up going and looking at my old MRIs, and I had modic changes. And so again, it took some time. We weren't commercially available. We're still doing clinical studies. But that summer of 2017, they said they were going to go ahead with commercialization. Would I join them full time? And so I did that in 2018. And I'm still working with Relievant Med Systems, now part of Boston Scientific. But I had the procedure done on me in September of 2021. So I'm now more than 3 years post-procedure, and I no longer have any low back pain. It's been eliminated. It was eye-opening for me to have quality of life back, to be active, to go hiking, to go skiing, and not suffer from all of that. And so as I've been on this odyssey where, you know, you never know where you're it's going to take you, somebody up there had a plan for me to go from medical school to residency to Cleveland Clinic to be in clinical practice, to have to stop full-time clinical practice, hospital administrator, didn't go into another hospital, did healthcare consulting to then work for Relievant Med Systems. because 2021 was 40 years after my first back operation. I wound up getting a solution to my chronic low back pain that I had had. And so it's another one of my adages that when things throw you curveballs, take it easy, keep your eye on the ball, and you'll connect with that curveball. Don't get angry. Don't get upset. Don't say, why is this happening to me? There was obviously a larger plan ahead. And so I'm now into my eighth year working with people at Relievant Med Systems, now part of Boston Scientific. Outside of my clinical practice, this is the longest job I've ever had. I certainly didn't think about that when I started with them, but you know, I was full-time clinical practice for 23, 25 years, hospital administrator 4 to 5 years, healthcare consulting 4 to 5 years, and now into my eighth year in med device.
But this sounds like, because of the personal improvement that you've had, this sounds like it has become, number one, fun, which was a prerequisite for you, and that it's also something that you're very passionate about because of the impact that it had on you personally.
Very much so. When I finished PEMBA in 2001, we had a nurse who used to do a hospital newsletter. And she came up to me and said, what would your ideal job be? And I said, my ideal job I'll never get because I'm not politically connected. I said, what I'd like to do is have an impact upon the greatest number of people that I can. And she goes, okay, so what is that? I said, I'd like to be Secretary of Health and Human Services. And I said, but I'll never get the job because I'm not politically connected. And so you're right. My job now, because there are over 30 million people with chronic low back pain, probably about half of them potentially are candidates for the Intracept procedure, basal vertebral nerve ablation. And so my job, which is really crazy when I think that for the first 30 years professionally, I had about a 10 to 12 mile round trip commute. I'm now on between 40, 50 or 60 planes a year traveling all over the country. Later this week, I'm going to be in California for a day. I'm then off to Phoenix, Arizona. I've been to Alaska. I've been to Florida multiple times. I've been to Atlanta. I've been to the Carolinas. And I kind of feel to some extent either like the Pied Piper or Johnny Appleseed, spreading the word that you don't have to necessarily suffer. I've had medical school classmates, because initially after my surgery, I posted it on LinkedIn and Facebook, who have reached out to me. And I said, well, send me your MRIs. I'll let you know if you potentially are a candidate for this. And I probably have a dozen personal people that I've spoken to that have gone on to have this procedure and have gotten beneficial effects, if not 100% relief of their pain, at least more than 50%. And that to me is really very rewarding.
So maybe taking a little bit of a deeper dive than you had intended here. So how accessible is this procedure nationally right now? I mean, how widespread is the availability of having this done for patients?
So this procedure is available in all 50 states. It's been performed in all 50 states. The challenge that physicians have, and you know, get back to you know where we started being physicians, is we struggle with insurance companies. We struggle with insurance companies to get authorization for procedure. When you've got a new procedure, the easiest thing for a medical for an insurer to say is, "Oh, this is new. There isn't enough science. It's investigational and experimental." This is anything but investigational and experimental. But we've been able to obtain coverage, counting insurers and how many covered lives they have, for more than 160 million covered lives. We still are struggling a bit with United Healthcare and Aetna. You know, the challenge with them is they have the ability to say no, and they can say there isn't enough science, even though there are multiple medical societies that have supported it. The fact that there are two Medicare administrative contractors that have given positive LCDs. And when we talk about the skills that PEMBA have given us, being able to present, have a cogent discussion about something, I've learned a whole lot about the Medicare system. And one of it is that if you don't like what a Medicare Advantage plan has said to you, you have the ability to appeal these denials from them. And the way that gets appealed is something through the Office of Medicare Hearings and Appeals, and you actually go before a judge and an administrative law judge hearing. So I have participated either by written document or personally by video teleconference in over 1,800 administrative law judge hearings over the last few years. One day I may consider writing a book about that experience of going through that, but one of the ways the Medicare Advantage plans get paid is they get paid on a per member per month. And when they get paid on that per member per month, their rate is affected by how frequently they have their initial decisions overturned at a later level, either by the independent review organization, Maximus Federal, or by administrative law judge. And just recently, I think both Aetna and United Healthcare have sued CMS because they've decreased their per member per month. And they're saying that it was done without obvious data and facts. But the data and facts are there. The insurers do lose, but until somebody holds a hammer to them, they're going to, you know, keep on denying. So again, it's a passion of mine. Every single time I've taken a new job, everybody says to me, so what are you going to do in retirement? And I go, I'm not retiring. I'm just transitioning. And I think that is the beauty of the skills that PEMBA affords us, depending upon where your focus is. If you want to be entrepreneurial, if you want to work in hospital administration or something else, you've got a long runway of lots of opportunities to have a fulfilling life. So even people say, oh, he's a retired orthopedic surgeon. And I said, I'm not a retired orthopedic surgeon. I'm an orthopedic surgeon who happens to be doing some other things, but I'm using very much a lot of the skills that as an orthopedic surgeon, part of my job is to go into operating rooms and proctor doctors by doing this. So that's really exciting to actually be standing in an operating room again, wearing lead and not have low back pain. That's pretty good. But to be in there and help assist physicians really make this part of their treatment algorithm has been very rewarding.
So what are the current roles in your job? You mentioned you have some role to go into the OR and to stay close to clinical physicians, procedures, that type of thing. And you mentioned the hearings that you've been involved in. What are the other elements of your role?
Education, as every new company, if they're doing well, they keep on expanding. And so we have new hires. So about every 3 months, we have a new hire class. And so I give them a webinar on etiology to low back pain. I then go on to give them lectures on treatments of various different types of back pain. Because again, because of my experience dealing with medical device salespeople in my professional career, I tell them the ones who had the character and the interest to not just know their device, but knew about the field that they were talking about. Because I said, me personally, I had more respect for somebody who didn't have blinders on and just wanted to focus upon what their device was because you sound like a broken record. But if you can talk about treatments for spinal stenosis, treatment for disc herniations, treatments for spinal instability, and other treatments for chronic low back pain, whatever doctor you're talking to is going to have more respect for you because you're not just talking about your device, you're talking about the field that you're in.
You know, it's interesting. One of the things that I just thought of as you were talking about your advocacy role with the payers, you mentioned when your orthopedic group was founded back in the 60s, Medicare didn't even exist. If we look at the expenditures that Medicare is now paying for orthopedic procedures, spine surgeries, hip replacements, knee replacements, those types of things, the increase in that expense for procedures that didn't even exist when Medicare was originally envisioned has played a major role in the amount of money that and the amount of tax dollars that are going in to pay for these types of procedures. How do you see the next 5 to 10 years, and how do you see us responding to that increasing expense over time while trying to gain some control over the rapid rise in the number of in the expense of our Medicare system and Medicaid system?
It's a great question, and it's one that put to me many years ago, is that I had a medical director from an insurance company say, yeah, I've never actually seen any medical device ultimately save us some money. It's just one more procedure to be done. However, interestingly, And I'll get back to your question in a second. Interestingly, we just finished publishing a health economics paper that demonstrates that these people who, when you eliminate their chronic low back pain, stop seeking medical care. So again, you've sort of addressed that issue, but it's frankly, we have these expenditures, and you mentioned joint replacements. 4 months ago, I just had my knee replaced. And if you can't continue to be active, and that's really in the world of orthopedics, we are the quality of life physicians. Otherwise, you get to just sit on your couch if your back hurts, your knee hurts, your hip hurts. You don't do much of anything. And we know that people who are inactive have an increase of chronic diseases, diabetes, hypertension. And so that is ultimately part of our challenge, though, is if we're living longer and we do have some quality of life, we probably won't be using as much in the way of medical expenditures. But there will definitely continue to be medical expenditures because we are living longer. You know, if we still all died, and that was, you mentioned Medicare. I remember reading the articles that 65 was made the Medicare eligible age because at that time, life expectancy was 19, that you would be 69 years of age. Mm-hmm. And so the numbers were all predicated, and I guess we can either thank or curse the actuaries on that. It was predicated upon the fact that you were going to be covered by Medicare for only about 4 years. I think mm-hmm. it's probably part of the challenge that the long-term care insurances have had because they did their actuarial work and they figured, well, people were not going to be in long-term care facilities for very long and it won't be a problem. Well, we've gotten better at keeping people alive. Right. So that certainly is a challenge from a financial standpoint.
Hold on 1 second. Yeah, I think that the changes in longevity and led to many different conditions becoming much more prevalent as we age, and it's certainly having an impact on cost. I thought maybe I'd switch gears a little bit right now because we're kind of reaching the end of our time. And I wonder if you would talk a little bit more maybe about specific mentors or mentorship and how it's played a role in your career. You mentioned as you went through several of these transitions that you reached out to colleagues, potentially people you felt were your mentors, to help you navigate some of these changes. But maybe talk a little bit more about the impact that those relationships have had on your career.
So those relationships have been, you know, extremely important. They're the people that have had the experience and as I like to say, the gray hair. I'm now the person, as are you, with the gray hair. But it's the standard line, you know, those who don't understand history are destined to repeat it. And I didn't want to make a lot of mistakes that were potentially avoidable with certain things that I did, whether it was actually performing a surgical procedure or administratively going ahead and do it. So again, I had jotted some notes. And again, one of these days when I truly do retire from a full-time job, I've gathered notes of words of wisdom that I was provided by these various different mentors. One of them, my partners, had a great expression, was a person convinced against their will is of the same opinion still. And if you think about the discussions that we have on a daily basis, if you try and force something down somebody's throat, there's going to be a lot of pushback. We just have to look at, you know, our national environment today. People have to come together and think about that. I had another mentor from residency who used to say, Dr. Marks, I want you to get up every morning. I want you to look in the mirror and I want you to say, how am I going to keep myself out of trouble today? And to me, those, you know, and I'm talking about things that, you know, I was told over 40 years ago and they've had a definite impact upon me. And so what I truly try and do is when I see somebody, if they're willing, is to provide some of that mentorship to the next generation. There are some people who push back. They're not interested. I know it all. And those are the ones that ultimately wind up getting in trouble, creating some problems, and finally, at some point, if they're smart enough, come to recognize, wow, I really should have reached out and got some advice. I really didn't know it all. And that's what's really important. But one of the other things, and again, I've had so many varied careers with the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons in the late 1990s, they did a survey both of physicians and of the patients that we take care of. And it said that patients' impression of orthopedic surgeons was that they were high tech and low touch. They were just trying to find it and fix it. And so ultimately, the Academy partnered with an organization in Connecticut called the Institute for Healthcare Communications. Mm-hmm. And again, because of my interest in PEMBA and things like that, I became a communications mentor. And part of that was a doctor that I had met at Yale University, who it actually turns out he was chairman at Yale, a fellow by the name of Dr. Gary Friedlander, who I still keep in touch with today. But I first met him in 1983 when he was a visiting professor down in Washington, D.C. at the Washington Hospital Center. And we continued to chat, and he goes, I think you'd be a great person for this. And it definitely improved my ability to communicate with patients, but also my interpersonal skills in communicating with lots of different people. But to me, the number one thing that we as physicians, we as healthcare leaders, is you need to demonstrate empathy. The person that you're talking to needs to know that they feel like they've been heard, they've been seen, and they've been understood. You may not agree with them, but that's not what empathy is. Somebody just wants to know that they haven't been dismissed. And all too often, as physicians in clinical practice, we rush right through. It's because we're on the clock. We've got to see this patient, this many patients and stuff like through. But improving your healthcare communication skills actually turns out to be a time saver, because when you actually listen to the patient, they don't keep on asking you repetitive questions because they already asked you a question once, but you didn't hear it. You didn't listen to it in order to be able to respond to them appropriately.
Well, I think that's a great advice, and it's a great way to end what has been a great interview. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule to join me on PEMBA On Demand today, and hopefully we'll get to have some additional conversations going forward. But thank you very much, Michael.
I appreciate it, Norm. Happy to be there. And again, a big thank you truly to the PEMBA family, which is, you know, more than 25 years strong, and certainly, as I said, made a huge impact in my life.
I hope you enjoyed Leadership Odyssey, Bridging Medicine and Business with Dr. Michael Marks. Thank you for joining us. Please join us in 2 weeks on December 26, 2024. My guest will be Mr. Mark Dodson and Ms. Catherine Nichols. They will be joining us for Episode 30, The Physician's Guide to Leadership Careers, Insights from Top Recruiters. We look forward to having you benefit from this content.
That wraps up our show for today. Thank you very much for joining and listening to the podcast. If you have any comments or questions regarding this episode, please feel free to add them in the comment section on our website, tiny.utk.edu/podcast. We love hearing from you and are happy to answer any questions you may have. I will add a link to the website below. Please also don't forget to subscribe to the podcast by clicking the subscribe button. Add PEMBA On Demand to your podcast library today. I would also appreciate it if you could leave a review of the podcast on your podcast player. Share the podcast with your friends and colleagues also. Please take good care of yourselves, and as always, good luck with your future.